On this episode of Still Loading, Benj Edwards. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Koval, and today on the show, I have a special guest for you all. I have a journalist. He is the associate editor at How To Geek. He's a freelance tech journalist. He is the editor-in-chief of his website, vintagecomputingandgaming.com, and he's a regular contributor to one of my personal favorite podcasts that you hear me shout out all the time, Retronauts. And if he couldn't tell, I'm pretty much reading it straight off of his website, so I don't forget anything. I have Benj Edwards on the podcast today. Benj, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Thank you so much for coming on. I was telling you off mic, I've been very much looking forward to this because I've heard you on Retronauts. I like a lot of the stuff that you focus on in your professional career. So I thought it'd be really interesting for not only to talk to you, but also for my listeners to learn a little bit more about like what you do and your hobbies and that kind of stuff. So to start off, kind of like just for the listeners, explain a little bit about like what you write about, like what's like what you focus on as a journalist.
Yeah, well, right now my main job is I have a full-time job at How To Geek, and so that's like my day job, kind of like where I write 9 to 5 every day. I write articles about how to fix your iPhone, how to change settings in Windows and stuff like that. But I also have, before that, you know, prior to that, I spent almost 15 years as a freelance journalist where I almost exclusively wrote about technology history and video game history. And so they let me bring that side of me in. And usually on a Friday or so, I will write some kind of tech history article for the site. And those have been doing really well for them, and they enjoy them. And I try to bring in, you know, whenever I can, I try to bring in some quotes from big names and stuff that give them a little bit more weight than just me saying, oh, this is the anniversary of this, and reading a Wikipedia article and regurgitating it or something, you know. So I try to do a little reporting, even though I don't have a lot of time. Like, it's prior to How To Geek, you know, I would spend weeks or sometimes even months on an article if I was doing some big in-depth thing. And at this site, I spend like a day or two, like a couple, you know, like 16 hours total per article.
So it's a fast turnaround time on those.
Yeah, but it has a positive side, which is I don't get too like in the weeds, and I get to cover more topics more rapidly. So I've been doing, you know, basically one a week for 2 years. So however many, so like over 100,
like 104 at the very least.
Yeah. So it's been over 2 years. So yeah, it's something like that. So I've done so much content about a lot of different topics, and it's really fun. I know some of the ones I've done about id software, you know, about Doom and Quake and Wolfenstein stuff have been really popular with our readers. So I always try to get those. Like, I just did a Wolfenstein 3D article not that long ago for the, I think it's the 30th anniversary. Yeah. So
yeah, because what, 92. Did it come out in 92? Okay, yeah. So that's terrifying.
I think I would know that because I wrote it. But the thing is I do so many, like it's hard to remember every single thing, because I've written almost 1,000 articles for the site since 2020. So
yeah, I mean, it's not surprising you'd forget like details like that. I it's funny, I'll have listeners like, or usually friends who listen to the show or other listeners will be like, hey, do you remember when you talked about this on the pod? Or do you remember blah, blah, blah? And I'll say, oh, whoa, I didn't know that. And they'll be like, you said that on the podcast. And I went, yeah, I did. I don't remember half the stuff I say on this podcast. I produce, you know, weekly content. You just speak into the void and you hope that you remember some of the stuff, some of the points that you made. Hopefully those points sounded intelligent. But
a freaky thing when that happens, like when you're finally old enough to forget some of the stuff you've done, and you come back and you look at like, who is this alien person who's talking in my voice or writing? And, you know, like, I have absolutely no memory of this. And it's really bizarre. But at the same time, it's also fun because you get to re-experience stuff. Like, I used to write music so much. I did a music website a long time ago called requestasong.com. And I would do the song so fast that I would write and record a song one night and wake up and completely forget it. Like, I had no idea what it was, and I'd go listen to it, and it was like a gift. Like, oh my God, my favorite artist left me a song. That's so great.
Did you ever wake up and listen back to something you wrote the night before and went, oh no, I've made a terrible mistake?
It's, you know, sometimes, rarely, but it was more often than not a surprise, because the less restrictions I placed on myself, the better the work was. So if I would labor on something for a long time, you tend to sort of iron all the spontaneity and fun out of it. And that can also apply to writing too, whereas you sometimes, if you just write things quickly and just get them out, they tend to be really good. And if you just work on them for way too long, you can just iron the soul out of it, like flatten it.
I feel like if I ever got better at writing, I'm not a good writer, I'm just being straight up honest, I'm not good at writing, grammar's awful, all that other stuff, but like I feel like if I were to actually practice it and work that muscle, I feel like that's the way I would probably do it, because too often I get obsessive over what I write, and I'm trying to make sure it's perfect and this and that, instead of just writing. That's why I like podcasting so much, is because I'm able to just kind of speak it out and not have to necessarily, like, I can't really, I mean, I can edit it to edit out any ums or ahs, or I begin a lot of segments with so, and then I move on type of thing. Now that I call it out, I hope listeners will not go back to the old episodes and listen to how often I do that, because it's a lot.
Super cut of you saying so 1,000 times. So. He says so a lot. So, like that.
Oh my gosh. I mean, it is a common word, to be fair, but even so, so there we go. There's another one. I say it all the time. Who knows? Maybe I'll edit this segment out so people won't do that, and this will just be for you and I. We'll see. We'll see where this ends up on the cutting room floor. But to move on, you focus, like you said, you focus a lot on vintage computing in your writing, and you speak to a lot of people who have either done stuff in the tech industry or game developers in the industry. What first got you into vintage computing to be kind of like something that's a hobby? Because you also have a vintage computer collection. So kind of how did you get started with all of that?
Yeah, I think the secret is to just have a vintage computer when it's new and never stop using it. So when I was a kid, when I was a kid, I mean, we had an Atari 800, which I still have, of course, but me and my brother still played the games on it. We loved it. Even up into the NES era and beyond, we were still playing the classics that we loved on there. And for some reason, I guess I realized, you know, there's a lot of different variations on my origin story, but one of the things is that I realized a lot of people were forgetting about Atari, and that it was actually still cool, like in the Nintendo era, the NES era and stuff. And I was wondering why none of the kids in my neighborhood knew what an Atari was. These are younger kids, because I was born in 81, so I was like, you know, 9, 10, kind of around that time, the peak NES era. And there were kids younger than me. Of course, they didn't know anything about Atari because that was before their time. But I knew it because I have a brother who's 5 years older than me. And so he, he was the Atari 2600, 800 era. And I wanted to preserve that. And also, you know, at some point, I guess I started getting into Atari a whole lot and looking into their computers and what they made and stuff. And I also had an Apple II Plus really early that my dad bought for me at a ham fest around 1990 maybe, and that was my first experience with programming BASIC, and I really enjoyed it. And and other kids weren't using Apple IIs anymore, and I was like, I don't know, I guess some of that I could credit my dad with feeding me this sort of vintage equipment, you know. At that time, that he thought this is a basic simple computer that's easy for a kid to learn, and he thought I could learn programming on it, and it fit the bill. And there were still, you know, even by 1990, there were Apple IIs still like at my school, even at that time. Like even when I started sixth grade in like 92, they still had an Apple II lab where they taught typing and stuff.
Oh, wow. And okay.
Because they didn't, Apple dropped support for the Apple II, I think, in 92 or something. It was lasted from 77 to 92. It was a really long time. So, but anyway, so at some point I realized that in this boring beige box PC world, that there was a whole generation of computers that came before that were getting thrown away and forgotten. And I'm like, I need to preserve this or save this for whatever reason. I thought about like, people are just going to throw this away and they'll forget about it, but it's wonderful and awesome. And this is even me as a 12-year-old, I was thinking, I don't know why I was thinking this way, but I started asking around and collecting every old computer I could find from everybody, from friends and family, and yard sales, hand fests, and, later thrift stores, and then later eBay too, you know? I just started collecting them all to preserve history. And I want to open the world's first computer museum, which is funny. Because
hey, there's crazier things. There's crazier museums out there. So,
yeah, I mean, they little did I know. I mean, there was, I guess at that time, the Boston Computer Museum was sort of getting off the ground in the early 90s and stuff. So, but there was no computer history museum anywhere at that time that was major. And so I ended up, you know, building it in my garage and then just sort of overflowing with computers. Now I'm dealing with the consequences.
Well, I remember seeing on Twitter a year ago or so, you started selling off some of your vintage computer collection, right? Or like donating it to different places.
Yeah, I got up to a point where I had, I think, over 300 computers and the accessories and everything for them, which is even takes up even more space, like in boxes, like keyboards and mice and disk drives and cards and whatever, you know, and manuals. And I had thousands of magazines and stuff. It was just insane. Like, and I had to, I knew I had to move. My wife wanted to move and I had to think about downsizing because I thought moving all that would be a nightmare.
Yeah.
And it was. I didn't sell it before I moved. So I moved in 2018 and I lost like 50 pounds, like literally me manually moving stuff 7 miles apart between two houses over a summer. It took me 3 months maybe to do it. And I just, it was like thousands of pounds of equipment and everything. And it was just a nightmare. It was a psychological blow too. I mean, it was like, my God, I think I've never been the same after that experience. So I had to get rid of something. And I ended up, you know, I think the Media Archaeology Lab in Boulder, Colorado, which is run by the University of Colorado at Boulder, they got a donation from a guy who basically paid me to pack up and ship that stuff to them. And I sold them for a nominal amount, but the real cost was my labor time because it took me several months to pack up. Well, I packed up about 100 computers. I still have like 200 something computers, but I packed up a bunch of stuff. I threw in a bunch of extra stuff, you know, and I packed it really well, put it in a shipping container and sent it across the country. And they have to deal with it now. And they've been, you know, sorting that out. And then later he also did the same thing with my magazines. So they have all my magazines, which is good. They all went to a good place. And
that's good.
I'm still downsizing. Like I still have way too much stuff. And, you know, my garage is overflowing with crap and I need to like get rid of stuff. It's just too much now. But I saved it long enough where, you know, the world has finally seen the value of this stuff, the history. Like for a long time, I was like, I got to keep this until people appreciate it or else it'll be lost forever. And now I see that, you know, there are more universities and museums and things interested in this stuff. And so it's not just me hanging on some dude in North Carolina with a garage full of computers. Now it's, you know, a much bigger issue and movement of history and academics getting into it and stuff. So I feel like I can let go, you know, of some of that.
you're not the sole person responsible for keeping this history alive mm-hmm. anymore. You see other people in the field doing the Lord's work, as they say.
That's
really cool, though.
The same is true with game, you know, retro gaming is, you know, we were once mm-hmm. all, you know, separated with before the internet and before a lot of the social media stuff. We didn't know of each other around the world, the collectors, you know, because there aren't very many. Like, who knows how many computer collectors are in North Carolina? Like, I know of maybe two other than me. And okay, then there's LGR Clint. He's a freak mm-hmm. or something, but there aren't that many, and we wouldn't know of each other unless we had Twitter or something, you know, or Facebook.
Yeah.
And so the retro gaming thing has grown so incredibly dramatically in my time.
Especially over the quarantine.
Yeah. And there was a time when, you know, I had a website in 1996 or five about classic computers and classic gaming is what we called that time. And it was hard to find anybody who was interested, even online. And then it grew slowly, and then I had a blog, and then there was, you know, some, like, I had the only blog about it for a long time, and then it's just grown so dramatically so that I don't even know everybody in the field, and that's how I see that it's so big around the world, and they don't know who I am, and that's fine, but it just means it's big enough to sustain itself as a discipline of some kind appreciate and preserve this stuff, if that makes sense.
No, I it's funny because there's even my uncle, for example, I wouldn't call him someone who preserves stuff. He's more of a hoarder is the better. And I shouldn't even actually hoarder is a negative. He's not a hoarder, but he is the type of person who doesn't throw out a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he actually has like a T99 or TI, what's 4A? Mm-hmm. 99. What's
TI-99-4A. Texas is? Yeah.
That's what I just was mixing it all up. Yep. He's got two of them mm-hmm. from when I played it as a kid, even though I was born in 89. Mm-hmm. So it was way before my time. Yep. I shouldn't say way, but it was definitely a couple of years before my time. But I still played it as a kid because my uncle had mm-hmm. one. And then even so, I still have this isn't as old, but I have like an old Mac computer from like the mid 90s. I forget what model it is. It's still in my parents' basement. I've told them don't throw it mm-hmm. out.
Yeah, don't throw it out. Macs are worth a lot now. They, in general, if they work, especially.
I hope it works. The problem is the basement is not well ventilated, so I'm a little worried about the humidity in there.
That's another weird thing about my collection was that I took a lot of stuff out of basements in the 90s and early 2000s, and then they spent 20 years in kind of climate control. So my stuff was in much, much better condition than if you suddenly found it in 2020 that had been in a basement for 40 years, you know? So the stuff I'm getting now from people, people still send me stuff or give me stuff. It's in absolutely horrible shape because it's been in an attic for 40 years or a basement, and it's just nasty. So,
whew. Yeah. How hard is it to clean? Do you end up cleaning up those computers and get them to work again? How hard is it to do that?
I will sometimes completely disassemble something and, you know, run some components through the dishwasher, even like to get junk off.
Like literally the dishwasher? Yeah,
it works great.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. I was not expecting that because you think like electronics and like, I understand you have to use something to wash it, but the idea of putting an electronic in the dishwasher, dishwasher just seems counterintuitive. Well,
the funny thing is my dad was an electronics engineer and they made their own PC boards, you know, printed circuit boards for their own products. Mm-hmm. And they actually used a dishwasher to wash some flux off of their boards and stuff like that. They actually had a dishwasher. And the funny thing is that it's the water that's the problem. So if you can get all the water off of it and out of it everywhere before it corrodes, then you're okay, you know. And also you don't want to use some kind of harsh detergent that will etch away at the plating of metals and things, because you know a lot of dishwasher detergent is very it's very strong. I don't know if it's acidic or base or whatever, but it's like it's very volatile, and also they have enzymes and stuff. So I typically try to just wash plastics in the dishwasher in a cold so it doesn't melt up.
Okay.
But I've also, like, if a board is completely nasty and it's not a one of a kind thing and I just need to clean it, I put it through the dishwasher. And then dry it thoroughly so there's no trapped water under or anything, and then it's fine and it works great. It's clean. So yeah,
that's wild. Do you put it in, do you do like the, like what people do with their phones, put it in a bag of salt? Not salt, I'm sorry, rice salt.
Yeah, I've heard that rice thing is sort of a heard the rice thing is sort of a myth, and it doesn't really work, and it could be damaging or something because it gets dust. Like the rice has this dust that gets everywhere. It's really nasty.
I mean, my wife used it before and it worked, but I don't know how much the dust would have damaged it. It wasn't working at all before the rice, and it did work after the rice.
I tried it. So it could be have nothing to do with the rice. Like
could just have dried out.
You know, my wife or daughter, I don't remember who it was, dropped their iPhone in the toilet one time, and I pulled it out and we let it sit, and then it stopped working, and I had to, I opened it up and it was just full of water. Like there's no way rice could get that out because it was trapped in there. And one of the problems is that like if you have, you know, if you fill, if you put a bottle underwater upside down, and you don't let the air get out of it, you know, first of all, the water doesn't really get into it. So you have to have two holes, one for the air to escape, for the water to come in. And if you get into a situation where the water is sucked into these small holes, there's like no way to get it out without displacing it with air or something. So you have to totally take it apart. You can't pour, like if you had a closed bottle with nowhere, I'm imagining the little holes on the bottom of an iPhone, like a charging port or like a microphone port. And there's nowhere for air to get in, for the water to get out. It won't come out. You know, it'll never come out. So you have to take it apart. Yeah. It's just crazy. Yeah. It's air pressure and stuff.
So you heard it here first, listeners. The rice method may not be the most safe way to fix your waterlogged electronics. So keep that in mind. Now that we've talked about your vintage computing collection and how you kind of got into vintage computers, how did you get into journalism? How and what made you want to tie your love of vintage computers to being a journalist initially?
Yeah, that's a great question. I started a blog, first of all, you know, vintage computing and gaming at vintagecomputing.com. And I think I had been reading blogs for a little while before that, like less than a year, around 2004, 2005. And I thought, hey, I could do this. It'd be really fun to write about what I enjoy, my hobbies and stuff like that. And at one point I was really excited about this NES clone called the Generation NEX. And that was created by Messiah, which is a completely modest name, by the way. Messiah of all things. Like, we're just going to completely resurrect the Nintendo. We'll just call it Messiah.
We're just the Jesus of Nintendo now.
Anyway, so Messiah created the NEX, and the press hyped it up, like, such as it was at the time, the blogs and everything, like, it was going to be awesome because they were parroting press releases. And I bought one, and it was absolutely horrible. And I said, man, I got to tell people about this. This thing sucks. The compatibility is terrible. The colors are off. The sound is off. And I was so disappointed that it inspired me to write this horribly scathing review of it. And I put it up on my blog. Like, first I posted a couple of, so it didn't look like it was just the first post on my blog. I put a couple other posts before it, you know, so it was like post number three. And then I sent it to like Kotaku and Joystick and whatever. And it was a huge hit. Like, I got thousands and thousands of page views. I was like, wow, I've been doing it the wrong way, because I'd been messing with music and trying to get, you know, attention that way. And I got more traffic in just that one post than a whole year's worth of like my music site, you know? So I was like, wow. And I think that attack and the, you know, follow-ups probably sunk that little company, but they, you know, it's not my fault, because they made really crappy products, unfortunately.
No, you just gave, you gave an honest review. If they made a good product, then it would, the backlash wouldn't have been there.
Yeah, I didn't try. I wasn't trying to destroy anyone. I just was trying to inform people that, hey, this is sucks and what you've read about it is wrong. So that's what started my career. And then I blogged for a couple of years, basically throughout 2005, the end of 2005, throughout 2006, and started, you know, I did some blog posts for Game Set Watch, which was Simon Carlos's blog at the time, and, you know, unpaid posts. And then I applied. I think at some point I was like, hey, you could do this as a freelancer for a career or something like that. And I, you know, wrote some people for advice and got some advice on how to do that. And then started in 2007, maybe early writing for money for like 1UP and PC World and stuff like that. So that was my transition. I guess I was naturally good at writing. I thought I wanted to be a writer when I was in high school. For some reason, I wanted to write the great American novel or something. But I just never had the patience to sit down and do it. So
I can feel you on that. I wouldn't either. Yeah.
And so I never would have expected, though, to be a career writer, though, for even though that was my ambition then. I thought, wow, I'll have to go to college and be like a computer science guy or something. So I don't know. So through the blog, I did that. And I just through necessity of needing to make money, I started writing for money. And then I just started writing for bigger publications. And I didn't make a lot of money, honestly. It's not a good business to write freelance journalism. But now I have a steady paycheck, so I'm relatively happy.
That's good to hear.
Health insurance, which is the greatest
thing. I feel like even if it was like a good gig to write freelance, I feel like it's still scary because essentially at that point you're kind of like a working actor, but instead of, you know, trying to look for your next part in a movie or something like that, you're just looking for your next place that's going to post your article and you can get paid for it. So it just seems like a lot more stressful of a job because it's like you have there's no security net underneath you. It's just constantly trying to grind it out to try to find a next place or the same website you've worked with before will like take up your next article or something like that. I could see how that would be a little bit stressful, only, you know, just a little.
Yeah, it's stressful. Yeah. There were a couple of years in 2010, 2011 was sort of my peak where I could make the most money. And I sort of actually made a good salary kind of those couple of years, but it was a ton of work and I had to work on the weekends and really long hours and stuff to make it happen. And then the fees, like I could get plummeted dramatically after that. There was some kind of mini ad crash or something where, you know, ad revenues went down and then, you know, competition increased dramatically. And so, you know, the novelty of me writing about this computer and history stuff was not as novel after a while because other people started doing it and I couldn't get the same fees and stuff. So it was a tough time, but I did a lot of work that I'm really proud of and that has, you know, made a lot of good connections for me with people like, you know, Steve Wozniak, for example, or any of the stuff I did about Jerry Lawson or Ed Smith or Carol Shaw and stuff. A lot of that work I've done is being cited in books and, you know, museums and all this stuff now. So even though I suffered for it, I think it was worth it because that was my goal was to not, it wasn't to make money, it was to preserve this history and, you know.
And you've interviewed a lot of really amazing people besides the ones that you mentioned. Like, I actually remember I was trying to find a way to contact Carol Shaw to get her on the podcast. I never did. But I found your article with you interviewing her. And I was kind of like, oh, someone already found her. Oh, maybe I shouldn't do this because someone has already done this. You know, like you did the legwork for it. But besides her, like you also interviewed, from what I see on your website, you have a list of notable interviews: Steve Mayer, Nolan Bushnell, Ralph Baer. He's passed away since, right? That was somewhat recent.
Was in 2014, I think he died.
Was it in 2014? Yeah. Who was I thinking of that passed away like a couple of years ago? Who was like a pioneer of maybe it was Ralph Baer, and time is an illusion to me.
Ted Dabney died, you know, a few years ago, 3-4 years ago. I don't know. The co-founder of Atari. I knew him too. A lot of people die. They're all dying. It really sucks. There was a time when I woke up, I had like a sort of existential crisis at one point, like 5-6 years ago, where I was like, I just sort of realized if I had never talked to these people, no one would ever know this. They would die and it would go with them to their graves. And so that's a lot of pressure to put on myself. I like almost had a panic attack. Like, so it's all up to me.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I've got to save history, you know, like, oh my God, you know, and at that time I didn't know anybody else doing it, and there wasn't a movement. There's now a great group of people, like at the Gaming Alexandria Discord I'm on, which is really mm-hmm. cool. So there's a really great group of video game historians now out there doing a lot of this work, and it makes me sleep at night because then I don't have to feel like I'm the only one who can do it, you know.
Yeah.
They've helped me move on to sort of be able to do my full-time job and not have to try to focus on the history completely. It's been crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see where this like retro video game history and tech history movement has kind of grown out of over the last decade or so. Because like for me, I first got into game history, believe it or not, from the Angry Video Game Nerd of all things. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, I mean, I liked his videos and whatnot, but it was when he would review stuff that were, it was like some type of peripheral add-on where I'm like, whoa, this existed on the NES, or you could do this on this on a Sega. And I'm like, that's really interesting. I had no idea. And that was kind of like the seed, you know, that planted a little seed. I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. And it just kind of blossomed out from there to when like, what is it? You would know more about this than I would, but the Play-Doh computer systems, like it was talked a bit about on Retronauts. When I first learned about that, and I know very little about it, but when I first heard about like what those systems were able to do, it just blew me away. And that was stuff that was happening in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, the Play-Doh, that was like the 70s. And if it weren't for Brian Deere doing all that work to research and report it, we wouldn't know a lot about it today. But that's the funny thing about history is that it's so imperfect, and it's always being written and revised. And, you know, we grew up, like I grew up with like some cursory knowledge of computer history, and I had to piece a lot of things together myself. And if you just didn't have that knowledge available, there could be a whole segment or a whole world that you'd never heard of, like the Play-Doh thing. Never experienced, and it's not wasn't mainstream enough to be in like a mainstream book until recently. You would never know about it, but they pioneered so many things on that, like online multiplayer graphical games and stuff, and it's incredible.
Touch screens to an extent too. Yeah, like wasn't there like a touch screen?
I don't know if it was a touch screen thing, but they had these plasma displays that were amazing, that were sort of like flat screen plasma displays, which are crazy because they were sort of higher like resolution and more compact terminals. It was so futuristic and weird and parallel to what we think of as the narrative that was created. A lot of the narrative was created by like Stephen Levy's Hacker's book. A lot of people read that, and he focused on Silicon Valley and the MIT crowd and stuff, and the whole hacker, like the Tech Model Railroad Club and the Steve Wozniak type stuff going on in the Homebrew Computer Club. And if it wasn't in those things, you know, it wasn't really covered. And then there was a thing called Triumph of the Nerds that Robert Cringely did. That was a really great miniseries, I think it was, or documentary on PBS that covered a lot of that stuff, but it had its own, you know, angle and bias towards what that guy knew of the Silicon Valley type area history. And so if it wasn't happening in like Boston or the Valley, it didn't exist. Like, so there's a lot of things, if it's in the middle of the country, if it's in Minnesota or Iowa or wherever, and even if it's cutting edge, those people acted like it didn't actually happen because they didn't know about it. So there's a lot of gaps to fill in. And that's one of the fun things about my work early on, was just being that gap filler and pulling out astounding things that no one had ever seen or heard of before, and saying, this is actually, this person did this, and there was someone, you know. So that was really fun. And I feel like I did that for a long time, and I tried to back away from doing that recently because it's, there's not as many stunning reveals anymore. And there's a lot more people working on the same stuff now. So it's not like you're the only person on earth who knows about this, which is the way it was for me for a long time.
So I can understand that. It's kind of like, if you can't, it in a weird sense, it's like if you can't be the one to break something new, it's not quite as satisfying, and not in like a selfish way, but it's just kind of like that's kind of like what you look for. Like if everyone's doing the same thing, you want to find a way to kind of set apart and do something that nobody else is doing, because like what's the point of doing something that someone is currently working on? Yeah. And it's kind of redundant at that point.
That is part of the thrill. I'd say I've really enjoyed breaking news topics and things like that in the past. And yeah, so I try to, I've tried to move to different things that are not being done so much if it's possible.
And it's hard to find, especially now with everyone. It's like we were saying, it's great that so many people are into game history and tech game history and preservation and tech history. But it also then ends up being like it's doesn't make it as exciting for the people who like yourself, who started on and like everything was a breaking news story because no one had heard it at the time. And it's just crazy. So we talked about how you got into journalism, and we've gone over some of your interviews. Who has been one of your favorite people that you've gotten to interview?
Oh boy, there's a lot of them. I mean, I talked a lot about my relationship with Ralph Baer, how he was a really cool guy, and we became friends basically. And I even went up to his house one time, and I stayed in his guest room for the night because I had no I didn't have a hotel or anything, and just flew back the next day. And he showed me, some of his documents, and we talked and showed me his inventions in his basement. And it was really cool. And that was fun. I still love Steve Wozniak as one of my favorite people. He's so kind and generous and a genuine you can just tell the genuinely kind, good people. And some of them are Steve Wozniak and Ralph Baer were both very good people who weren't out to manipulate their history or try to, manipulate you as a journalist or whatever. They just are they have nothing to hide necessarily. And they're just kind and actually generous and stuff. And there's other people who, you see the people, I'm not going to name any names, but there's people who try way too hard to control the narrative of history. And it's almost embarrassing. I'll ask you
off mic for those names. I won't.
Yeah. It's almost embarrassing there. And then there's people who are absolutely paranoid about it and they barely want to talk to you and stuff. And those aren't fun, but I really enjoyed talking to Carol Schoff. She was really great to talk to. Ed Smith is one of my favorite people. He's, one of the African-American pioneers of video games who worked on the Imagination Machine in the 70s at APF in New York. And he and I have, become friends somewhat too, because he's a great guy. So I love the great guys, the nice people, the people who there's a lot of there's some people who don't want to share credit. They want to showboat and sort of be the center star of everything. But the world doesn't really work that way, as there's always a collaboration going on. So there's people who accept that, yes, I did this one thing this one time and it was cool, but it wasn't just me. There were other people around me doing this stuff. And I really appreciate talking to those kind of people.
And even if for some strange reason in some crazy world that they did create something completely on their own without anyone physically helping them with it, that's still not 100% true, because they're still the products of their upbringing and the products of the people around them and their influences and the people who encouraged them. So even if no one else directly worked on a project, that's a weird mentality to have that kind of ego around a big thing when you're besides the fact that it's next level impossible to make, especially in computers and tech and stuff like that, in games, it's a collaborative thing. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to do something completely solo. But even if you take out that, the person's still a product of their entire life, of the world and culture around them. So there's always going to be someone that helps shape them to get to where they are, negatively or positively.
There's a lone inventor kind of mythos that we have in American culture where we pick one person like Steve Jobs or something and say he's the inventor of this or that. And it's just a cultural narrative idea. I don't think it's shared across all cultures, but it's an American thing. It's we have this independent spirit of entrepreneurialism and one person changing the world kind of thing. And that fits into that mold of that storytelling. It's like an archetype of a story that's told by journalists. And it's all stories. It's all culture. It's all variable and subjective. There's no hard facts, completely 100% ironclad anything in journalism or history. It's interpreted. And there's some have much more veracity than others because they're backed up by study and, you know, and by, backed up by corroboration between sources. Sure. But there's a lot of interpretation going on. And there's one other thing. Another favorite interview of mine was I got to eat lunch with Tim Sweeney in 2009 in Kerry before he was, now he's a billionaire, I guess. But yeah. We had just the most fun time talking about ZZT, his shareware game, over lunch. Mm-hmm. And it was just cool. And I've been trying to get him to do a follow-up, but he's so busy. He's like, maybe sometime, but anyway.
I was going to say, I to kind of reference back to what you're saying about this idea of like the lone inventor, the sole proprietor of some idea. I think a lot of that comes from how we're taught in school. Like we're taught, Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. Mm. He didn't really, but that's what we're taught. Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, and we're taught that about it because it's easier to teach that. It's easier to teach that than to describe the messy collaborative process that went into creating these things. And, because Alexander Graham Bell even work for the patent office and someone else patented the telephone and he just had like there's a whole thing with that he probably stole it. It's not been documented, but it's pretty damn shady nonetheless. Yeah, or maybe possible. It has been. I don't know. But it's stuff like that. So I really feel like it comes from just the way it's taught. And it's not necessarily done to be malicious by the education system. It's just this is just the way it's been taught, whether just for either sake of ease or just that's how they were taught type of thing, just passed down. So I wonder if that's where I feel like that's where it comes from. That would make sense.
It does.
To me,
I've put a lot of thought about this because I'm a historian or, amateur historian technically, but I'm a writer of history, and I compare it to math, and rounding is my metaphor. Like when you can calculate pi to infinite digits, but no human mind will be able to comprehend it. So you have to round it to 3.14 or 1.5 or whatever, something that can be understood by a human brain. And I feel like history is the same way. Whereas there's an infinite cascade of causality between every event, every molecule crashing against another. You could go to any infinite level of detail if you wanted to explain things, but at some point you have to chop it up into little pieces that a human brain can understand and understand quickly. And also, obviously, if you teach certain things a certain way, it fits a cultural narrative too. Like if you say George Washington chopped down his cherry tree, I cannot tell a lie. I mean, there's a reason why they teach kids that. It's to teach them some kind of moral lesson, right? So it doesn't matter if it didn't happen or if it's not accurate. It had a lesson behind it. And if we teach our kids that Steve Jobs was this wonderful inventor, who before he was 25 was worth millions of dollars and whatever. I mean, there's a reason why we might teach children that too, because we want them to be entrepreneurial or whatever. It doesn't matter if it's not completely accurate in every way. It's a cultural idea. And this is the thing that I even ran into this. Bill Gates, of all people, wrote an article 20 something years ago, 25 years ago, about the problems they had with compiling Encarta, the encyclopedia for different regions, because every region has their own set of facts. This person invented the light bulb in this country, and another country, another person invented the light bulb, because they are like a Brazilian invented flight to Brazil. But to here, North Carolina, we have the Wright brothers. And it just depends on how you parse what they did and how you qualify what they did. So the Wright brothers had controlled, powered, sustained flight, and they were the first, but someone else had controlled, powered flight that wasn't sustained. And then another person had uncontrolled powered sustained flight. And then so every region gets to claim their own hero. And that's part of the culture. And that's why I wish that people could see that history is so plastic and fluid and is completely culturally biased. And I mean, there's no way you can get around that because we're not machines. We're just people. And, you know, we think in terms of stories. I think that's our main like mental model is this some kind of prehistoric campfire story where we have like we tell something with a hero and an antagonist and a conclusion.
Yeah,
it has to just fit into that for our human brains to understand it. And so, sure, there's people who spend their whole lives studying one topic at a university, like an academic, but you can't translate that into a second grade history class. You know, you have to put it a couple sentences. So how are you going to sum all this up into just a couple sentences for a little kid in second grade to learn? So it becomes Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. See?
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's like you have to dilute these incredibly complex topics into such bite-sized, easy piecemeal versions. And not even just because kids are kids, like they can't like, you know, they're, it's easier to teach things in black and white and then add nuance to it later. Mm-hmm. But then obviously it can become complicated when someone's an adult and they don't want to learn that nuance, that the gray area that's in between. And that, you know, without getting into any of the issues in our political landscape, but a lot of it feels like it revolves around that. And we're not going to get into politics on this. Mm-hmm. That's a podcast that's not my own. to move on, we've talked about a bunch of the interviews that you have done and some of your favorites. Do you have any dream interviews left? Like you've said before, you've interviewed a lot of people that you've wanted to, and it's harder to find people that necessarily pique your interest in terms of a gaming history or a tech history standpoint. But are there any interviews, regardless of tech or video games, are there any interviews that you've really wanted to do and you just have not gotten a chance to? A dream guest that you'd love to sit down with?
Yeah, that's a great question. I definitely have a list. Like my number one is probably LeVar Burton. I absolutely love and admire LeVar Burton.
Yes.
And
he would be great.
I've talked to him on Twitter, you know, briefly, like little tiny exchanges over the last 10 years, you know, and he's such a cool guy. And I'd love to explore like his, you know, the cultural impact of his work and talk about some of that, reflect on that. And I asked him, I think I asked him during when I was doing my podcast, you know, didn't get a reply. But I didn't have, there wasn't a good hook or angle or anything at that time because it was a tech podcast, you know.
But yeah.
And there are people like, I don't know, like I'd love to interview Paul McCartney or something because he's, you know, my favorite musical artist of all time. But there's no, you know, justification for doing that in what I do.
Well, you could make the argument that since the Beatles quote unquote created stereo, you could loop that in, like shoehorn it into a tech thing with stereo sound.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, they
do the history of stereo sound and computing, and then you would cover the origin of stereo with the Beatles, interview Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
And then how it effect went into.
They didn't create stereo, computers. Though. You're misinformed.
They didn't. Yeah. That's a con.
It's one
that's
of those things they taught you in elementary school. It's not accurate.
Yeah, this is the Thomas Edison invented the light bulb of music, apparently.
Paul McCartney invented stereo. No. Stereo originated in the 50s, like stereo LPs and stuff. But the Beatles did stereo horribly for a long time. Their stereo releases were really weird, and they were like the second rate. They focused on their mono releases first, but
I really wonder where that narrative came from that the Beatles created stereo.
I think you just made
it up.
They
helped pioneer it. No, I heard it from other people. That's the weird thing. I didn't.
They did really.
I'll just made it up.
Weird stereo mixes that were bizarre. Like, and it had nothing to do with the actual Beatles. I think it was some of the engineers were making those stereo mixes, and they were like all the drums and everything were on the left, and all the vocals were on the right. And they would like swirl around and stuff. And it was crazy. And so Giles Martin, who's been remixing and remastering, has sort of tried to fix that by making a more modern style stereo image is what you'd call it, by, you know, making it a little bit more balanced, not all on one side or the other. Anyway, that's the Beatles. I could do a whole nother podcast on the Beatles.
You should totally do that. You should just do a, I don't know what you'd call it. There's a podcast for everything. Yeah. Okay. Now that we've talked about how you got into vintage computing and collecting, and we've kind of talked a bit about your career, I wanted my listeners to get to know a little bit more about you, since this is a gaming podcast. How did you first get into gaming, and what are some of your favorite games?
Yeah, first get into gaming probably when I was a baby. my brother, you know, we had that Atari 100 I mentioned. I played some games on that when I was a kid, like Donkey Kong and basketball and Asteroids and whatever. And then, you know, I love the NES when it came out. I thought Super Mario Brothers was absolutely magical and wonderful experience. And I was mostly Nintendo focused throughout the 90s, although I, you know, got a Sega Genesis and a Master System around the mid 90s too. I was messing with those, but the Nintendo software is so delightful. It's just so mm-hmm. well done. No one else, it's world class. No one else can match it. And also computer gaming throughout all that. I played a lot of shareware games. When I ran a BBS as a kid and teenager, like from 92 to 98. And so I had a lot of exposure to shareware games, and I played a lot of like Scorched Earth and, you know, Doom and Wolfenstein 3D and Captain Comic, Commander Keen, everything. All the Epic Mega Games, it was called Epic Mega Games at the time, Epic Games,
yeah,
ZZT, Jill of the Jungle, and all that stuff was fun, and that was a very formative experience. That's why I love Tim Sweeney so much, because he's like, he'll always be the ZZT guy to me, because ZZT mm-hmm. had its own programming environment where you could build and program your own games in it, in the engine. And that was, you know, the actual game itself, where you just walk around a town and shoot bears or whatever. It's not that exciting, really. But the fact that you could program your own games in that engine was absolutely incredible. And it spawned a big following. And
now for those, before you go on, for those who don't know what ZZT is, could you give just a brief explanation of it? Because most people, in all honesty, I bet you most of my listeners don't even know what shareware is, because I haven't really done a lot of computer stuff on my show yet. Yeah,
well, luckily I've written articles both about shareware and ZZT on How To Geek, if you want to look those up. But shareware is a concept where people would give away a copy of a game and ask them to, if they liked it, to send money to either register it or get a, you know, code later.
It's like a proto Patreon almost.
Yeah, it's like sort of like the first game demos basically were invented through mm-hmm. shareware, where you could send it out, and if you like it, you could pay for it. Or later, Scott Miller of Apogee pioneered what was called the Apogee model of shareware, which is the most lucrative model, which is they would give away the first episode of levels for free and say, if you like this and you want more, send us money. And that made them tons of money. So they would send, you know, people. That was like sending out the demo and having, with the registered copy, you'd get, you know, 20, 40 more levels or whatever. And that Apogee and Scott Miller basically invented that in the early 90s. And ZZT was Tim Sweeney's first game for Epic Mega Games, which is now called Epic Games. And that was created in 1991. And it was an entirely text-based game for the IBM PC that uses ASCII character cell graphics, like the text mode on an IBM PC. Mm-hmm. And with a little smiley face character is your person that you walk around on the screen with the arrow keys. And you can collect torches for light and shoot with bullets. And so it's very primitive, and it's like an overhead view of you walking around town or village or dungeon, and you just collect gems and try to solve puzzles. And then, but it had this built-in game engine that you could, like an edit mode that you could make your own games. People even made other genres in it. They figured out ways to make little shooters like Space Invaders. And I even saw mm-hmm. a weird racing game once where it captured the little player in a box. And when you move the player, it hit these program buttons within the engine that would move another thing around a track, like a character around the track. So just inventive solutions like that. It's really fun. And that shareware, you know, it gave birth to id Software's success too, because you know, with Wolfenstein and Doom and Commander Keen and stuff, they could do an end run around the established published game industry, which is one of the reasons they could do these ultra violent games that were very popular and visceral and action oriented, when publishers wouldn't touch that at the time because it was just too out there. So they could just send them directly out to BBSs, and it spread by word of mouth and by person to person, because they were great, you know. So that built that whole, the first person shooter was built off of shareware, that experience there. So
all right, so what would you say is, like, what are you playing currently then? Like, what's your console of choice currently, now that you know, with all the our modern luxuries and whatnot?
Well, I forgot to answer my favorite games too. I mean, some of my favorite games are Monolith Blood from 1997. It's a first person shooter. It's kind of campy and it's gory in a 1997 kind of way, but it's really great. The level design is awesome. And I love Castlevania Symphony of the Night. I love, like, Metroidvanias and stuff like that. And, you know, my recent favorite game is Elden Ring. I've been playing that on the PS5. I have a friend who sent me a PS5, and I've been slowly paying him back because I couldn't afford it at the time. But he got an extra one. Like, he was buying one, and there were two available. And he said, "Well, you want this?" And I said, "Yeah." So, Elden Ring is beautiful, wonderful experience. That's just mind blowing. It's like, it's one of those. It reminds me of seeing Zelda for the first time on the NES or something, that just expands your horizons. And it's so beautiful. The world building and the art style is so consistent and amazing. And, you know, I've been playing Skyrim slowly over the past 5 years on my Switch, I played it when it was new.
It's a slow burn.
Yeah, it's a real slow burn. I play it, like, you know, for a month every year. I get back into Skyrim mood, and I keep continuing my character. I played through Halo Infinite not that long ago, the campaign mode, and that was really fun. I have an Xbox One S or something. I don't know, somebody traded me a joystick for, so. I traded a joystick for it, and it was.
Oh yeah, I forgot you make joysticks as, like, a little side hustle.
Yeah, it's been fun. I sort of cooled off again now on it recently, but, you know, over the years, I think I've built over 300 joysticks by hand.
Oh wow!
And the BX110 is the only one I've been making. It's a Super Nintendo style thing, because I had some of the parts specially made with custom plastics and things like that. And it was really, it's embarrassingly expensive to pre-order all that stuff. And I'll probably never make that money back. So I sell them for a lot of money. They're like, I wanted to sell them for $100 a piece or something, but they take, even with this stuff, I have to order all the parts at, like, retail prices, and then it takes me a while to put them together, and it's just, like, not worth it if I don't sell them for something like $200 or something, you know. So I sell them for 200 to 220 variable, and I still don't make a lot of money on it or anything, but people want them so bad that I have to stop. Like, I'm only selling 5, and then I stop, you know, every once in a while, if I need something, people are happy to trade. Like, you know, like, I'll build them a joystick and they'll trade me something that's worth roughly $200 or something, you know. And I've gotten a lot of cool stuff that way, and people are happy. They love those joysticks. So I'm not doing it as a business. It's sort of like a hobby that they pay me for my time to assemble it, in a way. But it was fun. It was an incredible experience at the height in 2018, 2019. It was like a crazy roller coaster, and that could be another podcast by itself.
I have one more question for you before we kind of wrap things up, because we are about at our time limit for today. So I do this for a lot of my interviews, and my wife is not into a lot of the same stuff I am. She's not into gaming, not into anime, very much an opposites attract type of couple. But I always ask her, like, hey, if she has a question, for my guest. She doesn't know anything about my guests, doesn't know mm-hmm. doesn't know anything you do. So this is the segment of the podcast called Questions from Courtney. And her question for you, and not related to anything, if you could delete one sport from existence, which sport would you choose?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I think horse racing, maybe.
I think it's the dumbest sport. I'm kind of for that. You don't have to apologize to me. I'm not into horse racing. If you said hockey, we'd have an issue. But with even so, with horse racing, I think you could make a solid argument. I mean, there's also animal cruelty a lot of times involved in that.
So. I will. This is my evisceration of of horse racing. It's a hobby of the ultra rich. It's a hobby of the ultra rich. It's boring as hell. Because it lasts. I mean, it's not even boring. The race is like over in 2 minutes, and then people gamble on it, which is a whole nother, you know, level of shit. Sorry, pardon my language.
It's okay.
It's a whole nother level of shit. No, just kidding. Let's spell it out for the kids.
I have an explicit label.
The horses, the horse treatment, you know. And then it breeds tiny little people who ride on their backs, which is really weird. So there's jockeys, and nothing against any jockeys out there, but it's just a bizarre thing. So I feel like it's more of like a social experience for the ultra wealthy. And so that's just why I don't like horse racing. But, you know, I'm not going to judge anybody if you like it. It's not my business.
No, that's fair enough. So you heard it here, folks. We are getting rid of horse racing starting today. That's the first sport to go. And with all that said, Benj, thank you so much for joining me in this episode. This was a lot of fun to talk to you, to get to know you, and hopefully my listeners got to know a little bit more about you, as well as the world of vintage computing and collecting. And also, I feel like they learned something. The fact that I was completely wrong about the Beatles, the fact that they learned what shareware is. This has covered a wide gamut of topics. Before we head off, though, Benj, is there anything you would like to promote? Anything that you're currently working on? Where can the people find you online? All that good stuff.
I don't know. Let's see. I just recently finished the first draft of a book I'm writing about the Virtual Boy with Jose Zagal, Dr. Jose Zagal of University of Utah. And it's a platform studies book on the Virtual Boy. And Jose wrote most of it. Like, I've written a couple chapters out of it and helped him edit it and stuff, but it's been interesting. And I don't know when that's going to come out. It'll probably be next year sometime, but that's keep an eye out for the Virtual Boy platform studies book. You can find me on Twitter at Benj Edwards, where I'm ridiculous, and BenjEdwards.com, and also, you know, check out howtogeek.com and search for Benj Edwards, and you'll see like my history stuff on there. You might enjoy that. I do some gaming stuff too.
All right. And as usual for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to email me, you can email me StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use, because that helps more people find the show and it makes me feel nice and fuzzy. Warm and fuzzy, whatever that expression is. You can also support it monetarily, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. For $1 a month, you'll get the episodes a few days early at a higher bitrate, kind of stealing from the Retronauts model a little bit on there. And you'll get access to a patron exclusive Discord. And for $5 a month, you will get 2 bonus episodes a month. And it's usually very random stuff. In fact, I believe I have one due out in a day, so I have to figure out what the hell I'm going to cover for that tonight. Patreon.com/stillloadingpod. But a better place that you can spend your money is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And that will do it for this episode of Still Loading. Benj, thank you once again for joining me.
Oh, yeah, it's great. I was going to say, it's great to have you on. It's great to have me on. Thank you for having me. And obviously, this is a high-quality podcast because you asked me to be on it. So, man, exactly. I hope you guys give a lot of money through Patreon to support it.
And that will do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening, and I will see you all next time.